Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natanael Zelis-Pole. On today's episode, curating curiosity and creating community.
The whole point of the exhibition was to get visitors to actually think about the various ways that people interpret the environment around themselves. The point being that anybody can interpret things in any way that they can. They just have to be invited to do it. Personally, I think about exhibitions that I work on as invitation for interpretation.
How many of you have actually seen an Erev, that 95% invisible boundary of telephone poles and fishing wire that is simultaneously imaginary and completely real? Odds are you probably don't know where to look, even if you rely on it every Shabbat. Fifth chapter of Tractate Eruvin, called Ketzad Me'abrin, or How Do We Build an Eruv, takes a lot of the theoretical discussion of the preceding chapters and makes it relevant to the 21st century Eruv, particularly when it discusses the boundaries of cities. And that's a lot like what Zachary Paul Levine did in his critically acclaimed exhibit on Eruvin at the Yeshiva University Museum. Zachary Paul Levine has produced dozens of exhibits, installations, and educational programs for cultural institutions throughout the U.S. and abroad, and is the principal of Throughline Collaborative. While working at Yeshiva University Museum, he curated It's a Thin Line, the Eruv and Jewish Community in New York and beyond. Currently, he is director for archival and curatorial affairs in the National Institute for Holocaust Documentation at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and serves as vice chair on the Council of American Jewish Museums. Zach, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So one could say that a museum exhibit embodies some of the same characteristics as an Eruv. Both bring people together, both create a new kind of space, and both require meticulous and intentional design. How did this become your job?
When I first started working on this project, it was kind of a sign to me. I'm not a particularly observant. I'm Jewish, and I knew what the idea of an Eruv was, but I didn't really understand the complexities of it. And I was talking about it with one of my mentors at a conference, at a multi-day Jewish museums conference, shortly after I started thinking about this project. And we were standing in the African History Museum in Detroit, and all the conference participants were standing around in a circle for the beginning of our tour. And my mentor, he leans over to me, sort of nudges me, and he says, "Look, we've just made an Eruv." His whole point was that we created a community by agreeing to create a boundary around it and create a common space. And it was at that moment that I realized that, in fact, what museums and cultural institutions and really every institution does is create common spaces where we can, in a sense, feel a sense of belonging and, in many cases, a sense of being at home. And that got me to think very differently about what Eruv is about, what its intent is, and that it made it something that was far warmer. And I can definitely say, in fact, with this exhibit, you know, I had some of the most dedicated docents in our museum roll their eyes at me and tell me that I was stupid for doing this exhibit. Why would anybody care to come and see something that at the end of the day, it's just going to be pictures of fishing line and telephone poles? It didn't make any sense. It boggles the mind. That's part of it. But then the other part is, it's not just about the objects, but it's like, why would there be interest about this thing? It's this weird esoteric topic that's only important to a small community of people. Well, sure, I can understand both of those. But I think what we proved is that, in fact, looking at illustrated books and photographs and drawings, and not to mention the contemporary art pieces that we included in this particular exhibition, there's in fact an incredible visual and material culture around this topic. But also, you know, we're talking about New York, we're talking about many hundreds of thousands, if not over a million Jews, for whom the Eruv is, if it's not something that they use, it's something that they're aware of and maybe they explicitly do not use. They don't hold by. For that community, that's pretty important. That's a big community. And if our goal for this exhibition was to get people to think differently about Eruvin, to think more expansively about its meaning and its use, then it's absolutely critical that we also look to the community that uses it, because no doubt many members there could also benefit from an exploration of the topic. And I'll tell you that I gave a lot of tours of that exhibit. And there's this one couple, they were from, you know, I don't know, Queens or Manhattan, observant couple who came back time and time again. I probably gave them a tour 3 or 4 times. And what they said to me is that every time they came to this tour, and they were observant, they used the air, but what they said to me is that every time they came to the tour, they learned something even newer about Eruvin. And this wasn't about me. This was just about the depth of the topic. And it really changed the way that they thought about this thing, which had seemed wholly utilitarian, that in fact was about so much more. You know, sure, it's about people carrying on the Sabbath. Okay, but for whom is this really critical? It's critical to parents who need to carry babies and push strollers. It's critical to the elderly and the infirm who use canes, who have to carry medication. This is critical for somebody who's in a wheelchair who otherwise couldn't get out on the Sabbath. The Eruv is about making it possible for the most vulnerable members of a community to observe the Sabbath and to enjoy the Sabbath. Again, it is about something that is so much bigger than just a string. You know, it's interesting. The whole point of museum work in the past might have been to preserve objects, preserve important materials, or materials that were deemed important to human history and humanity. I personally see my work very differently. That is to change the way that people see the world, to hopefully get them to think very differently about how they relate to their communities and hopefully provoke them to improve their communities. And in the case of the work that I'm doing right now, it is literally to end genocide. That is what the museum does, and that's why I'm doing this work.
Absolutely. I'm sure that's really fulfilling work. In your role as curator for It's a Thin Line, you collected dozens of artifacts connected with the history of the Eruv. What was one of the most surprising pieces of material you came across?
It was an interesting exhibition in terms of the types of objects that you have. Many exhibitions will sort of center on a particular set of objects. This one was all over the place, because to express the story of the concept of Eruvin over two millennia, it means that you need to understand the development of the built environment, but also the things that people do within that environment, and then how they adjust those actions and the things that make those actions possible to negotiate that environment. So for example, up until the 20th century in Eastern Europe, people would make their cholents for the Sabbath by, you know, they'd throw everything into the pot on Friday, and then right before the Sabbath, they would drop it in a communal oven, which was the, you know, the local baker's oven, which as it went out, it was fine, but it kept enough heat that the cholent would cook and stay hot by the next morning. And they had to carry the cholent home. But the only way you could carry that home is if you had an Eruv that made it permissible to do so. So we had a photo of a cholent oven from 1920s Palestine. We had a cholent pot from the 19th century. We had a painting of people bringing cholent home on the Sabbath from the mid 20th century. This is all to say that all of the objects were particularly bizarre. The coolest object, the one that I just love, the one if I could, I would make wallpaper out of this, was a volume, The Laws of Eruvs by Hazon Ish. It was a very important book published at the beginning of the 20th century about Eruvin. And what was so incredible about this book, you know, the majority of the book, you look at it, it's just Hebrew text. Maybe a couple of those pictograms that you see in Masechet Eruvin, but other than that, it's just text. But then you get to the end, and the last couple of pages are just these little images, these little line drawings that you, again, you'll see them now in Talmud volumes all the time. But up until the early 20th century, there was no standardization for how you would define space in pictures in Jewish books. So the Hazon Ish has image after image after image. I mean, there's probably 100 of these images just across multiple large pages. It's incredible, because what you see here is not just the thinker trying to give form to images. It's in fact the creation of a holy Jewish visual language that doesn't exist anywhere else. Can you argue that Jews have a visual tradition in one way or another, an artistic tradition? There are arguments for and against. For me, and this is, I'm only speaking for myself, the way that I've always conceptualized Jewish culture is that it stems from a particular relationship with a textual tradition. Well, this visual interpretation of that textual tradition was absolutely incredible. And this relates absolutely to how Jews negotiate space, how they move through space, and how they work within different types of space to make it possible to be Jews, to follow the commandment to observe the Sabbath. It was mind-blowing and absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't reference that in addition to the exhibition, we published a book called It's a Thin Line, Eruv from Talmudic to Modern Culture. And the end pages actually show some of the pages from this volume by the Hazon Ish. It was truly incredible.
Sounds like a really fascinating exhibit. I wish I could go see it. So let's jump into the daf. The Talmud on page 55a discusses how the shape of the city can affect its legal boundaries, a discussion which has practical halachic implications for the shape and size of an Eruv. Given that Manhattan is an island, and one that is topographically diverse for its small size, what sort of interesting artifacts or discussions about the geographical aspects of its Eruv were included in the exhibit? Or did you uncover in any research?
Gosh, a lot. A lot. Manhattan was not the first Eruv, or New York was not the first Eruv in the United States, but I think it was the second, probably. As an aside, Eruv history is not very well documented because communities set them up for themselves and then they're ephemeral, they go away. In fact, they're only important for 25 hours a week as it is in some respects. So the first Manhattan Eruv, which was founded at the very beginning of the 20th century, used basic parts of the built environment to create an Eruv around the entire east side of the city. That was the elevated train that went from South Ferry all the way up to the top of Manhattan, and then the sea walls along the east side of the city. There was considerable argument and debate among halachic authorities. Basically, it came down to an argument between members of the Lithuanian community and members of the Galician community on the Lower East Side. A prominent Galician rabbi wrote a book establishing the Eruv, and many people held by it. A lot of people didn't. In that case, it completely used existing structures in the landscape. By the 1950s, the L was being dismantled. By 1955, it was gone. So as the L was being dismantled, rabbinic authorities started to think, all right, well, what are we going to do if we no longer have any Eruv in New York or in Manhattan? So there was thinking about, okay, well, maybe the entire island and the sea walls in the island could suffice as an Eruv. And so there was a considerable study. One was established essentially using the sea walls around the city that encapsulated the entire island. Again, not everybody agreed. Some held by it, some didn't. And there were certain areas of the island that would not have been part of the Eruv because they simply had too many people passing through them. You can't have a certain number of people over a certain number of people or passing through an area within an Eruv for it to be halachic on a daily basis, for it to be a kosher Eruv. By the 1980s, a number of modern Orthodox rabbis started to do some investigations into the physical structures that made up the Manhattan Eruv. And what they found is that a lot of the sea walls, for example, had deteriorated or were just no longer there. Areas that were thought to have been solid at one point had now just become beaches, which were not sufficient to compose a boundary. And so an effort was made to create a much more halachically robust Eruv on the Upper West Side. And that's the one that was established in the 1980s that really contained a smaller portion of the city, but and served a particular community. It went from Lincoln Square up through the Upper West Side. Over time, that Eruv has been expanded or it's been brought into contact with other Eruvin in the city. All of this is to say that since that time, over the last 40 years or so, rabbinic authorities in New York have thought differently and far more technically about the boundaries of the Eruv in a way that they couldn't in the past. And let me explain why they couldn't in the past. A lot of it comes down to the way that the Jewish community and the leaders of the Jewish community in different periods understood their relationship with local authorities. When Jews arrived in New York in the 19th century, a lot of the rabbinic authorities didn't totally have a sense of how to relate to government authorities. One of the things that you need when you establish an Eruv is an agreement with the local government, specifically with the sovereign or the king. Well, if you come to the United States and we don't have a king, but instead we have a government that seems to be changing over every couple of years, how do you make an agreement? So it took some rethinking about how that agreement would actually work. And in fact, for this first Eruv, it's not even clear where the agreement was. There was some, you know, I think somebody thought, oh, maybe he made an agreement with a local policeman or something like that. But by the time we get to the 1980s and up until the present, the Jewish community understand clearly how government authority works in the United States, that there really is no contradiction here. You're making an agreement with an institution, not with an individual, and that's fine. But also that to establish an Eruv doesn't just mean you go and say, all right, that seawall is okay, or I'm going to run a piece of fishing wire from this telephone pole to that telephone pole. Instead, you need to work with the city, with utility companies, with the state, possibly with the federal government in a lot of cases. You have to work with all of these different parts of the city and so on to get this thing to work. And that's just the boundary. So it became far more complex. And so to address that complexity, both in terms of the topography of New York, but also the administrative topography of New York, became far more complex, in many ways, much more interesting. What we end up with today is something that is a cluster of Eruvin. And I'm just talking about Manhattan, but the entire country has this. You have clusters of Eruvin that are far more carefully laid out, considered, and maintained than they were in the past. in part because now we can do that, whereas it was not necessarily in the mentalité of the people earlier on, nor was it something that they were necessarily able to achieve. I will say that the first mayor to sign an agreement with the Jewish community was Robert Wagner. So Robert Wagner leased the city of Manhattan to the Jewish community in 1959 for the purposes of the Eruv, because in fact, it's not just an agreement, it's a leasing of that space to make a kosher Eruv.
Thank you. That was really enlightening and a really important perspective, like a historical perspective. This point about governance and relations between Jews and non-Jews as it relates to the Eruv, it comes up in the next chapter called Hadar, or One Who Lives, which discusses the laws of Eruv with respect to a courtyard shared by Jews and non-Jews. So there, as you explained, the Talmud rules that in order for an Eruv to work in such a space, the Jewish resident must ask permission from the non-Jewish resident by symbolically leasing the latter's right to the space. For all of their physical and conceptual minimalism, Eruvin around the world, and especially the New York metropolitan area, have generated pretty serious controversy, especially considering the fact that most non-Jews have never even heard of them, let alone seen them. Of course, there's that notorious Jon Stewart clip, and in recent years there have been zoning wars in places like Mahwah, New Jersey, and Staten Island, New York, and all over New York metropolitan area. In some cases, though, posing residents simply didn't want large groups of Jews moving into the neighborhood. But in others, the Jews building their Eruv perhaps stepped on people's toes and backyards without thinking long and hard enough about their non-Jewish neighbors. Did you attempt to reveal this darker side of the Eruv in the exhibit?
So, you know, I want to push back on a couple of things. I wouldn't call it a darker side of the Eruv. In fact, it's every community that establishes an Eruv establishes it differently. They have different considerations in terms of the needs of their own community, but also how they are going to relate to the rest of the population, whether they are non-observant Jews or non-Jew. Also, I actually found that clip from The Daily Show extremely helpful in illustrating this concept to people who were unfamiliar with the Eruv. So I would rather, I personally tend not to think of it as notorious, but in fact, really helpful. We featured it in the exhibition. At any rate, yes, we absolutely did that in a variety of different ways. What we found is that the debates about contemporary Eruvin come down to a couple of different issues. One is when an observant community starts to grow in a place where there's a non-observant community or a less than observant community that doesn't want the nature of the Jewish community to change for one reason or another. And that was the case in Western Long Island, which got very ugly in the courts and was really, honestly, I personally felt very saddened by it because it just reeked of terrible discrimination, and it was within the Jewish community, in fact. There are other places, such as parts of Queens, where Eruvin have gone in and the entire fabric of the community changed in a relatively short time so that businesses that had catered toward a general population or toward a Latinx population, eventually they closed and were replaced by Jewish businesses because you had more and more Jews moving into that area. And so the whole nature of the economy and ultimately the social fabric changed, and many people who had been there for a long time felt that they no longer had a community. But then there are other places where Washington Heights is an example, where as the Eruv was constructed, the people behind the construction of that Eruv did their best to work with the broader community to find out ways that they needed to have a voice in this construction, create public spaces that wouldn't be perceived as a Jewish space. So it can go in a lot of different ways. There are ways that we covered all of this in the exhibit, primarily by showing, you know, newspaper headlines, the Daily Show clip, for example. But also, I spent a considerable amount of time going out and interviewing a lot of people all over the tri-state area about issues related to Eruvin and about specific Eruvin to understand these issues. So with respect to Long Island, we talked to some of the attorneys that were active in this. With respect to feminist issues, we talked to a number of Orthodox feminist activists who had been involved with the establishment of Eruvin and had very strong perspectives on this. We put all of this together in digital interactives where visitors could watch excerpts of films to help to understand some of these more tricky, in your terms, darker dimensions of Eruvin. We did do this, but it was in a way to unpack debate. I want to make that very clear, that it wasn't to show any dirty laundry, because in fact, this isn't dirty laundry. This is people who feel extremely strongly about this concept, which is truly foundational to Jewish practice and, in fact, to Judaism.
Thank you for the pushback. I appreciate it. And your perspective is important and a lot more informed than mine. On 55b, the Talmud talks about which unusual structures can be used to form the boundary of a city, including headstones, stables, and watchtowers. We often think of urban and suburban Eruvin in terms of telephone poles and wires. What can you tell us about the more unconventional structures used in the Eruvin of New York?
So Manhattan has had multiple Eruvs over time, and the Eruv that was put into place first in the Upper West Side in the second half of the 20th century included roughly 200 gates that were attached to utility poles, light poles, and so on, that made it possible to effectively close the streets as you would, let's say, come to Central Park, go up through Harlem, and so on. These gates were not necessarily ever used, but they were there. And they're no longer part of the Manhattan Eruv, but they're still existing, and they're all over the place, and they're virtually invisible unless you know what they are. What they are 3 to 4 foot tall PVC tubes that are painted the color of the light poles that they're attached to, as I said, usually on the western side of Central Park. And they were put there in agreement with the city and utility companies and so on. And in talking to the rabbis that helped to establish this Eruv and finding out about these, they put me in touch with the engineer who developed the Eruv. So that Eruv was established out of the Lincoln Square Synagogue. And at the time that we were developing the exhibition, the synagogue was changing buildings. So I went into the building, and we were literally going through closets full of old junk. And we found one part of these gates, which was an aluminum apparatus that you would attach to one of these PVC tubes so that you could open the gate. And the way that you open the gate was you'd pull off this PVC sleeve and there'd be these sort of plastic spools. And then you would weave the spools through this armature and then stretch these four plastic tapes across the street to close the gate. It was really complex, super strange, but it worked. But what I really wanted was not just this apparatus, I wanted a gate. So now this is where I, you know, hopefully there's no statute of limitations, and there is a statute of limitations or well beyond it. But so late at night, I went into the park with a couple of people from the synagogue where we knew that there was one of these gates, and the gates technically belonged to the synagogue. So we went in with a crowbar and we took one of the gates off of a light. And then we took it back to the museum, cleaned it up, and put it in the exhibition. And now I believe it's part of the museum's collection. I'm not entirely sure. But that was, I mean, it's this thing that, again, they're all over the place. You don't see them. But we were able to take that out, sort of be kind of Indiana Jones about it, I guess, pull it off of the light pole, put it in an exhibition, and there it took on a completely different resonance. And it helped us tell this story in a radically different way.
Wow, I love that. Sure, that was one of your more thrilling moments in your career. The Mishnah on 57b describes the painstaking way in which city limits were measured, with a rope 50 amot, or about 75 to 100 feet long, up mountains, down into valleys, and across rivers and canyons. Though it's not talking about Eruv construction as we know it, it's a good reminder of the real, difficult, and often thankless work done by community volunteers to construct and check Eruvin. How did you caption this human effort in the exhibit?
A lot of it on video. We put together this digital interactive about 12 different Eruvin. We also made a video that was about the general story that we were telling in the exhibition. And in doing these various media components, I interviewed people who were involved with the maintenance of Eruvin. So for example, in Edison, New Jersey, I went out and met the rabbi who oversaw the Eruv there, who also brought in the police chief and utility workers to illustrate how they maintain the Eruv with bucket trucks stopping traffic and so on. I met somebody else who for that same Eruv is a volunteer, but he's, I think, a handyman or something. And his whole thing was working within a park to make sure that the Eruv lines that were running across the park and the uprights that were going literally nailed into trees were always in fine shape. So I met those people. And in that case, they had, you know, I think over a dozen people who were volunteers, a couple of people who were paid to maintain that Eruv. In a case like Manhattan, there I interviewed the rabbi who at the time oversaw the Eruv, who talked about really what is a Herculean task for one Eruv checker. They have one person in Manhattan who's the Eruv checker, who every, I think it was Wednesday, checks the Eruv. It's repaired on Thursday and double checked on Friday to make sure it's kosher for Friday night. The thing there that's just really incredible is that this one person who is a volunteer, as I understood, or was at the time a volunteer, is dealing with a city that is ever changing. And that's really all city. You know, maybe a crane knocks down the line. Who knows? But this is always going on. So we really tried to capture both the, you know, understanding the logistics behind it, but also meeting the people who are involved with that maintenance. And the thing is, the maintenance itself is, you know, it's stuff from a hardware store, fishing line, it's nails, you know, it's wire conduit, it's very basic stuff. And as I said, not the most interesting materials for a museum exhibition. On the other hand, you put them on a pedestal and put a plexiglass cover over it, and then it takes on a different valence. So it worked. And then when we had that adjacent to the stories of the people who are using these materials to ensure that thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people can keep the Sabbath, it took on a very different valence. So it was critical for us to tell those stories and to involve that human aspect. Absolutely.
For sure. I'm always in awe of the Air of Checkers, really essential work.
The exhibition opened November of 2012. It was open for about 3 hours. And then we had to evacuate the building because Hurricane Sandy was coming.
Wow.
So the building was closed for a week, week and a half. And Hurricane Sandy, for all of its destruction, did provide us with an additional artifact. And it was a sign published by the Five Towns Eruv Committee about the effects of Hurricane Sandy on the Eruv. So we included that poster, which reminded the members of that community, of those communities, what actions were permissible and were not permissible without an Eruv, because it wasn't clear when the Eruv would be able to be reestablished. We had to include that, one, because it was an object of the moment, but two, because again, in your terms, it related very much with the human implications of Eruvin and the fact that these things have to be maintained and are maintained on a weekly basis, and that something like a storm can, in some respects, upend life on the Sabbath for communities. Something that people take for granted, but when they're not there, it's a big change. But what was really unique was when we had people from the Five Towns come and see that, and so they saw themselves, they saw their community. It was strange, but it also tells us that, you know, sometimes, you know, you've got an exhibit, but there's something new that comes in that you just have to put in, because It was so critical to have that there.
Yeah, that must have been a really unique experience to add an artifact to an exhibit after it's already open. It makes me really, you know, think about the fact that it seems like you really kind of created, you know, a living Talmud. You know, there's an important idea that there's never too many times to look at a text. There's always something, you know, you could find. And Talmud says you can't compare someone who studied a text 100 times to somebody who studied 101 times, because every time you learn it, you learn something new. So I'm really appreciating this idea of you creating a kind of a living Talmud that you can walk into. And maybe every, you know, museum exhibit is kind of like that.
Well, two things. First of all, thank you. That's a beautiful way to put it. I'd never thought about it that way. But in fact, very much to your point, one of the things that we did in the development of this exhibition was reach out to every synagogue, every Jewish community that we possibly could, hundreds of them, and send out surveys to their members to get their thoughts on Eruvin, and particularly to find stories about Eruvin. And that was a stab in the dark. We didn't expect to get anything. We got hundreds of responses and many fantastic stories of people talking about how they had made accommodations, how they needed Eruvin, how they hated Eruvin. Like, you ran the gamut. And we picked, you know, maybe 100 of these, excerpted them, and we put the text all over a very large wall. So in fact, what we did have was interpretation of this concept mixed with some reportage and so on. Now, on the idea that a museum exhibition is in itself a kind of Talmudic enterprise, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. In fact, the way that many museums think about their work over the last 10, 15 years tends to be in the realm of something called participatory, that you come into the exhibition, you're not there to be passive. You are there to express your own interpretation of an object, to interpret it. Our job is to provide a visitor with the means to understand a story by maybe putting it in their own words and interpreting it themselves. That's not to say that the work that the curators do is not important. It's far from it. But instead, that the role of the museum is to provide a space where people actually can interpret this work and make it relevant for themselves. Because the whole point of the exhibition was to get visitors to actually think about the various ways that people interpret the environment around themselves. The point being that anybody can interpret things in any way that they can. They just have to be invited to do it. Personally, I think about exhibitions that I work on as invitations for interpretation. This is a bit, you know, I'm a bit long-winded here, but Absolutely. Your interpretation of what we do in museums is to provide a Talmudic experience.
Wow, that's kind of mind-blowing. On 59A comes a statement that is probably one of the most important in the entire tractate for the project of urban Erevan. The sages teach that a city, even one with a public domain running through it, may be enclosed with an Erev to allow its residents to carry throughout it on Shabbat. There's just one small problem. Modern cities don't have walls. That little problem has been the subject of a century-long halachic debate, one that has launched tens of Jewish legal books and perhaps hundreds of creative solutions, and certainly thousands of shouting matches in synagogue. Perhaps the most well-known of these solutions is that of Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelit, also known as the Chazon Ish, who you mentioned before, who might be considered the champion of the modern urban Erev. Chazon Ish proposes that the facades of city buildings can serve as walls, and the streets in between them as entrances to one big shared private space with millions of people in it. It's certainly inventive, but it's only one of the ways in which rabbis have bent over backwards to find intricacies and obscurities of Jewish law to make the Erev work. But of course, that's pretty difficult to illustrate in a museum exhibit. Were you able to provide a peek into this legal complexity in It's a Thin Line? And if so, how?
Yes, we absolutely did. In a couple of ways. One was using that gate that I mentioned. These gates around the Upper West Side were a solution to essentially creating those clear boundaries along the streets. More generally, the way that we did it was by using maps of cities at different periods, some that were Eruv maps and some that were not, to illustrate how the changing landscape of a city caused Eruvs to be designed differently. So for example, we had a map of a medieval German town that had the innovation of an Eruv gate at the end of a number of intersections so that it marked where that Eruv was. That gate illustrated for the members of that community, for the people on that street, where the boundary was. But then we had a copy of a map from Odessa from the late 19th century, which no longer had walls, but instead had an elevated train track and a couple of other structures that could be adapted and in fact were adapted to create Eruv boundaries. We contrasted that against a number of historic maps of medieval walled cities in Europe to show how easy it would have been when you had a wall, but in fact there were other structures that you could use. Something that we used to really zero in on this elevated train and elevated railway example was actually we had a huge blow up of one of the original designs for the elevated train in New York for the Third Avenue elevated train, which was the Eruv, which really showed how that structure worked with having the posts and the beams stretching across it to illustrate that in fact, this wall of gates absolutely was halachically sound in terms of the Chazon Ish's interpretation. Maybe it wasn't a wall, but it was a wall of gates. And in fact, now that I think back to it, that really was the main innovation that I think the Chazon Ish was getting at, that in fact, you no longer really needed to have walls. What you needed was gates, as long as the gates were continuous. It was a different way of thinking, but it was one that just took some time and for people to get used to.
For sure. And you said you had those illustrations from the back of the Chazon Ish's book.
So one of the things that we actually had in addition were a number of illustrated books from the early modern period. So from 17th century, 16th, 15th century, that were these beautifully decorated books that showed what the Chazon Ish was doing, but in incredible detail, incredible artistic detail. So, you know, we had the Mishnah or the whole Jewish law, rites of old laws and the oral systems of Maimonides' commentary and so on, which was published in 1698 on this incredible manuscript that goes into incredible detail about gardens, city walls, and so on. If a house has a hole in it, if it has a crack in it, could that wall still work for an Eruv? These were just absolutely gorgeous volumes that showed the artistry that went along with the thinking about Eruvim. But the other thing that we had was that we had some of the first printed editions of the Talmud. So we had the so-called the Pizarro Talmud, which was printed in 1534. This is one of the first Hebrew books ever printed by Gershon Sonchino. So you might know that everybody knows the Sonchino imprint. So Tractate Eruvin was in fact probably one of the very first couple thousand Hebrew books ever printed. Definitely it was one of the first tractates of the Talmud ever printed because it was so critical to Jewish practice. What's really cool though, as everybody who's ever looked at a Masechet Eruvin knows is that it's not just filled with the text, but it also has these pictograms all over the place. Well, you see these occasionally in a couple Masechot, maybe you'll see it in Sabbath and so on, but it's all over Masechet Eruvin because the ideas in this particular tractate, in two volumes of it usually, in fact, the ideas here are so complex that they need to be represented in some other way than text. So we actually had two different volumes. We had the Pizarro that I just mentioned, but we also had an edition published sometime in the 1600s that instead of having images, it just has blank spaces around the text. And there, the reader was invited to draw the ideas for themselves on the page of this Talmud. And in a couple of pages, I recall that we actually saw some drawing. The point being that the only way to actually understand this concept as the Chazon Ish illustrates in that one text is to do it outside of text, outside of words. It has to be done in drawing.
Wow, I love that. It's really fascinating to see that how pictograms evolved from that. And black and white kind of 2D drawings you see in standard editions now, to, we have whole books with 3D computerized graphics and diagrams. But I'm really stuck on that doodling space. I love that. Every Talmud should have that normalized doodling.
And to go back to my initial spiel, this is about creating a visual language, a Jewish visual language, outside of the architecture of the shape of the Talmud page. This is something totally different. It's the only way that you can understand a ravine. And then if you sort of move through time, you see how those images have to be adapted and applied to the changing built environment that Jewish communities live in. And it also gets to this idea that you have this thing that is invisible to people, figuratively and quite literally in many cases, that has such an incredible impact on ability to observe the Sabbath, but also so much more, how they interact as a community, how they're able to conceive of time even. And it's this tiny little delicate wire in the sky in many cases. The thing that I haven't really said, but I think I've tried to convey, is that there's incredible beauty in the intellectual world created by Eruvin and around Eruvin, ethereal quality to this thing that at the end of the day is very practical, but is also so much more.
Absolutely. I couldn't think of a better way to describe the spiritual tightrope in the sky that is the Eruv. And it reminds me of a Mishnah in Tractate Chagiga, which says that the laws of Shabbat are kaharim hatulyin besara, like mountains hanging on threads. Mountains, significant, weighty, beautiful, hanging miraculously by the thread of human connection. And you, with your exhibit, have helped so many people appreciate that miracle. Zachary Paul Levine, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. And if you like what you heard, leave us a review, subscribe, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.